Hello, everyone. This is Greg, your host of Goddamn GameCube. Welcome to Season 3. If you enjoy listening to our show, consider subscribing to us on YouTube for exclusive video content. Thank you and enjoy today's episode. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Goddamn GameCube. Greg and Beppy are your hosts today. Our friend Derek is back with us again.
Hey.
We are continuing with our retrospective of Metal Gear Solid with Super Monkey Ball is the fourth one.
Hell yeah.
So here we go.
Surprise.
Yeah, surprise. So anyway, we're going to talk about Metal Gear Solid 4. I actually avoided absolutely everything about this game. I knew nothing about it going in. I actually just finished it like 2 days ago in preparation for this, so I am very fresh, so I am ready. Beppy, take it away. This one is interesting, for better or worse.
Yes, this is the fourth Metal Gear Solid game. It's the final one in the timeline. I think, in general, this game gets a bit of a bad rap, but there are still some objectively terrible decisions in it.
Yeah, okay.
So this is set in the future. As opposed to the past, which is kind of cool.
Yep.
50 years later, there's a lot of kind of super, even more futuristic stuff than we saw in Metal Gear Solid 2. The protagonist is Solid Snake again, and he, because he is a clone, he has aged rapidly, and he is now an old man, which figures pretty significantly into it. And I just want to say that, like, that's awesome.
Yeah, I just want to make sure our audience who has never played these games understands, like, they're probably hearing a lot about these different snakes from different decades. Mm-hmm. In this game, you are playing as the Snake from Metal Gear 1 and 2.
Yeah, yes.
It's the modern Snake.
And Metal Gear Solid 1 and 2. Yeah,
excuse me, I almost made a mistake. Oof. You are playing as the Snake from Metal Gear Solid 1 and 2.
Yes.
So, yes.
Metal Gear 1 and 2.
And yeah. Both. Yes. I'm right on all cases, yeah. I guess, right?
This is going to be a shit show either way, so let's just roll through
Let's just roll through.
Yes, so I love that. I think this is... So, for clarity, I actually started playing this game before any of the other ones. I just thought the old Snake thing was really compelling and interesting, knowing very little about the series. I didn't finish it at the time, but so I went back to the other games and played those and then finished it. And it's such a fascinating experience because it pretty much, its objective is to wrap up the first three games and create kind of a contiguous storyline. I think in a lot of places it's successful, some not so much. It's definitely a much longer game, a lot more ambitious, a lot of balls in the air. Where to start? Honestly?
I was just going to say, like, well, we're going to talk about the ending much later. I just want to say my initial impression of this game, the first several hours, I think this game plays awesome. Mm-hmm. I finally kind of got what I wanted from this franchise. You're being rewarded for playing better, for stealthing better, for doing a better job, which I really liked. Mm-hmm. It also left an impression on me where I have never seen a game franchise where there are how many entries? 5, 6, 7. And it creates a trend line through the whole chronology. And for the most part, it makes a lot of sense and holds up. We'll talk about the last 10% of the game later.
Yeah.
But when I was sort of, you know, in the middle of this game, you know, I'm 1, 2, 3, 5, 10 hours in, I was like, Metal Gear Solid has done a pretty good job, like, connecting how this game makes sense with Metal Gear Solid 1 and 2.
Yeah.
They did a good job for the most part, but let's get into it as best we can.
So basically, it's a very kind of, for the most part, pretty somber tone.
Mm-hmm.
The character of Old Snake really resonates with me for a lot of reasons. And it's so interesting, too, that, you know, even in his last kind of, no matter what, he's never really compromising on, like, you can play a Solid Snake again, you've always wanted to, but now he's an old man.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so cool because I've read, you know, interviews about how he was basically trying to impress upon the player that if you want him back, he's going to have to keep going out on these missions and it's going to start taking a toll on him.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, in a lot of reasons, you know, for a lot of reasons it does. And certain things about, like, the way he presents himself and his character is so, like, gruff and stoic and just kind of keeping people at arm's length. And it's really just, like, it's such a tragedy that he's, like, what, like, 38 years old
and he looks like he's
70 or 80.
Yeah.
And it's so cool to me that something I picked up on is that in the first couple of games, you know, he's always smoking, and it's like, it's a very cool kind of 80s trope where it's like the action hero is having a cigarette.
Marlboro Man sort of thing.
Yeah. And now it's like pathetic. Yeah. It's like, and everyone, it's like socially unacceptable, and everyone's telling him to stop smoking, and he's hacking up a lung every 2 seconds. It's so awesome.
Yep.
So this game, there are 5 acts. Which is very different from the previous structure, each in a different setting. The first one is in the Middle East, and there's a really cool sort of opening cutscene where you're kind of just being exposed to how the world works now. There, you are actually, before even all this, you're flipping TV channels. Do you remember this part?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's just showing like what type of programming is on in like the dystopian future they've created. And it's so cool to me because everyone is acting so like inhumanly. Mm-hmm. It's like, so even like, you know, forget about warfare, but like basic culture is like unrecognizable.
Sure.
Like, I think like, so the one I frequently watched in the past was the talk show.
Oh my God. My absolute favorite. Yeah. The interview with David Hayter.
Yeah.
I love that one.
And
let like, your dreams drive you. I didn't actually say that, but the
interviewer is just like talking over him and like putting words. So the actor who David Hayter, who plays Solid Snake, is being interviewed on a talk show, and she's just kind of like talking over him, putting words in his mouth. And the one I watched this time, there's like a cooking show. Did you ever see that?
I think that's the one I watched.
I vaguely remember that one.
I think I watched the cooking show.
It's fucking, it's like really violent and really insane. And there's like alligators walking by with like dynamite strapped to them and stuff. And it's just like, just bonkers stuff. And in between, there's all these commercials for the PMCs, which are like, you know, the private military, like Blackwater companies that you're encountering in this game. And so pretty much the future that you're presenting is that, so the Patriots introduced in Metal Gear Solid 2 through sort of the blending of human and machine life through nanomachines, the ubiquitous like kind of magic almost, you know, I think this game in general is kind of like a cautionary tale about like the, you know, the Internet of Things, smart. You know, everything, you know, everyone being perfectly in sync.
They're kind of doing like machinery, taking technology sort of narrative. Too far.
Yeah. There's a lot of that. There's a lot, you know, even, you know, in those TV channels, they're showing you a little bit of that. The opening cutscene is Snake. It's almost like a poem where he's saying, you know, war has changed. He's saying it over and over and talking about how, the Patriots' level of control has sort of tightened so much where they control every aspect of war and can control its intensity.
Yep.
And they're doing this for like economic purposes. And, you know, there's kind of like this thesis that is referenced, I think the report from the Iron Mountain is what it's called. It's in real life. And it's so strange because people can't seem to figure out if it's like a conspiracy theory or a real report, but it's essentially like in order for there to be lasting peace, there needs to be lasting war, like perpetual war.
Yes.
And that's like what the world is right now. Like no matter where,
it's in a perpetual state of violence for industrial military complexes and money and
people
PMCs
are just being fed into it.
It's just
constant.
There's a lot going on here.
And I thought it was so interesting that this first setting is very like Call of Duty-ish.
Yes, that was my first impression.
And you never really had a Metal Gear that was in that kind of setting before.
Yes.
And it's so cool because like you're kind of, I think because they were kind of maybe being politically sensitive, they don't paint either side as like the right one, but you kind of sympathize with the rebels because they're so like less, you know, they have less technology. And shortly after, you know, you kind of see them fighting these PMC troopers, the Gecko are introduced, and these things are so fucking horrifying to me because they look a lot like what's coming out of like Boston Dynamics right now.
Yes.
You know, like they
look like giant metal robots with human legs.
Very uncanny.
And it's kind of like the legs bleed and stuff.
That's why it's really freaky.
And it's like you wouldn't necessarily put it past it to be like these are like artificially grown in a lab or something.
Yeah.
It's like it's really disgusting and just they make like cow noises and stuff. And it's kind of just taking like Metal Gear into like a routine kind of bit. Like these are used for you know, to
these little Metal
people.
Gears are all over the world.
I also love how you can't defeat them. So like,
it's really hard.
Like, you absolutely have to avoid them, which I thought was really cool. So correct me if I'm wrong. So in the opening sequence, you're able to pick a side.
I never tried to take.
I avoided everyone on both sides.
But it's cool though, because you're introduced to this conflict, and Snake is clearly like sneaking in for some reason, and you can tell he's not really, you know, on the rebel side. He's just kind of sneaking in, and they do such a great job with this opening where it's a great like sort of teachable moment where they kind of fake you out by thinking he's going to do the whole cardboard box thing, and it gets crushed by one of the Gecko, and it shows you that it's a more streamlined version of the camo system from Snake Eater, where his new suit will mimic the texture that he's rubbing up.
Yeah, you have, it's an adaptive camouflage system. It's really cool, where if you lay down in an environment for long enough, you will gain that camouflage. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's definitely a leg up from the tedium of having to navigate the menu in MGS3.
Yeah.
I believe Snake also says his suit is also functioning as a muscle suit because he can't get around as a 70-year-old man.
Right.
It's actually helping him move.
Yep. Yeah. And you shortly thereafter find out that he's been hired by Colonel Campbell from the first game to kill Ocelot, whose mind has been controlled by Liquid, as we talked about.
Yes, they've merged at this point. my God.
And so Ocelot, Liquid Ocelot, as he's known in this game, and it's so funny to me that he's always wearing around an ID tag.
Yeah.
Like, he's the man with like the biggest identity crisis.
Yeah.
But he's like, so that's why Snake is there. And Ocelot is trying to control the Patriots because they've become such a ubiquitous sort of entity that whoever is in control of them can control like every aspect of human life. So I think it's kind of like the logical conclusion of that character, who has such an inferiority complex that he would want to control the world. So that's why you're there. You're kind of introduced to these characters and little gameplay elements bit by bit as you sneak through this part. I did like it's a really cool kind of change of pace to be sneaking through a war zone where there's two sides that you're not like, because you're always in previous games just sneaking past one opposing force.
You can really sneak through this without being aggressive towards either side,
right? So because, correct me if I'm wrong, so the going into this game, the only thing I knew about it was that Snake was an old man. I did not know going in that it was because of rapid aging syndrome.
I didn't either. I thought that was really cool.
Right. So going in, I was like, okay, so this takes place far in the future, like decades.
I had the same thought.
Like decades after MGS2.
Yes.
And so, because you're introduced, like you're thrown into that opening, the first mission.
Yeah.
And you're just playing as Snake and haven't seen any of the other characters yet.
Yeah.
Right. And then later, there's that scene where he's in the graveyard, the cemetery. And then Otacon shows up, and he's still young. So I'm sitting there like, wait a minute.
Dude, I had the same thought.
And then they mentioned Snake is suffering from rapid aging syndrome, which blew my mind. I was not expecting that.
Do you know
at
what
all.
I thought? When I knew nothing about the game, I thought you played as Big Boss from the 60s. Like, I thought you were the guy's, okay, 1960, he's like 30. Okay, maybe this is in the 2000s where he's 7. It's not realistic, but okay, no, it's because of the rapid aging, which is really interesting.
Yeah. Would you have preferred it if it was like actually if he had aged naturally and it was in like the 2050s?
No, what I think is really cool is Kojima does this thing again where I think a plot point is stupid, but then he reveals why it makes sense.
Yeah.
They do that so often, whether it's the heart attacks in the first game. Why am I old in this game? Oh, it's because of a rapid aging process.
I do kind of like how it takes place only 5 years after MGS2 because it just shows how quickly the world fell into the dystopian nightmare that it's in
after New York incident.
It took only 5 years to go from where we were in MGS2 to that.
And it's kind of cool because I mean that in its essence was a sort of a predictor of 9/11, and after 9/11 we started, you know, the war on terror, and it makes perfect sense that it would, you know, kind of resemble that in this own way. But interesting little note that I don't believe I brought up in MGS2 is that when you're playing a Snake, your aim is actually a little shaky. Mm-hmm. When you're playing as Raiden, it's like rock solid. So then you're already kind of seeing the signs of age.
Sure.
Liquid says you're drowning in time.
Okay.
All that stuff. And it's I like this first act quite a lot. You're introduced fairly quickly to Drebin.
Monkey Box.
Let's talk about Drebin.
So
he's a big part of this game.
My initial impression was this is the Resident Evil 4 merchant.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that's kind of all it was. And I actually, okay, I'm trying to put this out of my brain where, like, later in the game, I absolutely hated it. But in the beginning, I actually thought it was, like, cute. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of quirky where there's this guy who has a monkey with him and the monkey, like, drinks soda. And he sells you guns and sells you upgrades and stuff. But you can also buy guns in the menu. But what I thought was really neat is that you get money by downing enemies and selling their guns automatically,
yeah,
which is kind of cool. I actually thought like the buying and selling in this game was a cool aspect that I didn't expect.
Yeah.
Maybe later in the game I hated this character, but in the beginning I actually thought it was neat.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't really care about him, but I love his monkey.
I love the monkey. Monkey Bucks.
Love the monkey, Little Gray.
He's fine on his own. The problem is he eats up a lot of screen time for a game that already has way too much going on.
Yes.
So his whole deal is, in the future, all the guns are ID locked, and he's, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but
He strips off the digital serial
right, so he's the only, apparently he's the only one who's able to hack into the system.
He's one of many.
Okay.
He's Drebin 893, so this is happening all over the world.
Oh, okay, but he's one of many, then this brings me to my next point. It's like, why couldn't you have had Otacon do this and just spare us... Like all the characterization you give this new character in a game that already has an insane
and he's a weapon launderer essentially.
Yeah. I mean like, cool idea for a character.
Well, I mean,
because if there's anything this game needed, it was just to trim the fat. So this is I may be getting ahead of myself here, but it's like as far as my how I feel about this game overall. If you just sort of strip this game down to its most essential elements, there's not really much I would change. So it's just mainly a matter of what I would remove.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's too much bullshit.
Yeah. So there are a couple things I would straight up alter and do differently. But for the most part, it's just there's a lot of just extra unnecessary shit that the story would not suffer from having removed.
Sure.
And Drebin is one of these things.
I guess my bigger question about Drebin is the whole gun system is that it's such an expansion of whereas you go from like MGS1 where each gun and, you know, item had a purpose. And now there's kind of a lot of guns that do the same thing.
It's kind of a shooting gallery.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of in two minds about it. I feel like there was definitely a lot of resources devoted to this shop mechanic that maybe, you know, could have been used elsewhere. Or not at all. I don't know.
Like I said, I think they were doing the Resident Evil 4 merchant thing, but he got too much screen time.
Yeah, I do like how pretty early on too you're kind of consolidating all your radar stuff with the eye patch.
Yep,
the solid cool. eye. Mm-hmm. You get the Mark II, which I didn't really use at all. It's kind of just a cool like remote control thing. Like mm-hmm. ideally, like you'd use it for reconnaissance, but let's just play the game.
What I thought was cool about the Snake Eye is enemies can hear it. So you can't walk around with the night vision all the time or else enemies will hear it,
right,
which is
it'll
cool.
ping off their radar. Interesting.
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
Yep. There are a couple of missions where you actually get a warning that they will hear you if you keep it on.
Wow.
Yeah, okay. Pretty cool.
So shortly after that, you wind up catching up with Meryl from the first game.
Yeah.
And her new squad. Who includes Johnny.
Oh, boy. Oh, God.
Who is the guy who shits his pants in every other game.
Well, he's not revealed as Johnny yet. You would know who he is, but they don't call him that.
It takes some time. I don't think they drop that.
Well, the
that
first
until...
time you see him, he's shitting in like the barrel.
It's like, well, okay, if you don't know who the shitting guy is, in, and they call him Akiba, right? Or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's the guy who has the exclamation point hair and some other guy.
Yep.
And what I did like about it was that it kind of already imposes the tragedy of how Snake and Meryl used to have a relationship and it didn't work out because he got caught up in all this Metal Gear bullshit.
Yeah.
And he's kind of essentially wasted his life and she's moved on without him. I did like that part about it, too. But the rest of these guys, I could pretty much take or leave.
Yeah, I understand.
I did like the frogs. I thought they were really tough.
Yep.
They show up a couple times in this game. They're all women, which is odd. But they, I was going non-lethal until I encountered them, and it was like
I just started shooting.
They're just like jumping all around. I'm like, oh, we got to get this done here.
Yeah,
they're really tough.
Can you handle them non-lethally?
It's really hard.
Okay,
you can.
All right.
So I like that a lot. They introduced the boss unit here. And I think they're like the scariest ones for sure.
Yeah. Yeah,
I used to think they were my least favorite boss crew of the whole series, but upon revisiting the franchise, I have a newfound appreciation for them.
Just a bunch of like really, really crazy women.
Well, just, you know, because I think now it's the Cobras have been reduced to what is now my least favorite.
Wow.
Character wise. Okay, look, character wise.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
Like
yeah,
the
yeah.
boss, the boss fights are cool, but I'm just saying, like, just them as people.
Yeah.
I just cannot take them seriously. I mean,
go ahead.
The B&B Corps, I like the idea of them just being brainwashed, like mindless slaves at this point. Like, they've just snapped emotionally and just have no, like, they are now devoid of independent thought.
Well, it feels a little bit more grounded in the universe rather than, oh, here's a guy who's here's a lightning boss. Like, why?
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
They're kind of, they take a lot of cues from the bosses of the previous three games. They are just kind of augmented by tech and, they're just like, I don't know. They have a very, intimidating presence during that first cutscene.
Yeah, they do.
So you run into Liquid here, and man, what an absurd cutscene where he turns on his thing, and everyone freaks out and starts throwing up. And Naomi is reintroduced here, and I couldn't care less about that character.
Yeah.
And she eats up quite a lot of screen time.
Oh God. She's played by by Jennifer Hale in both games, isn't she? MGS1 and this one?
Yes.
Yeah. And for some reason, her British accent is gone.
Who also portrayed Emma Emmerich.
Oh, yes.
So
I mean, I didn't think this cutscene was bad. Where like they kind of show you how the nanomachine control is working.
It's just kind of because you have... They show you it working for Meryl and how her squad, like, you know, syncs up and how they can... You know, they're a better focused battle group because they're working in tandem. But if someone was to gain control of that, to hack it, like the power that they would wield over people is insane.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really cool premise for this game.
Right. And we do need to get back to the whole idea of Liquid's arm. merging with the consciousness of Ocelot. So it's like... it's really interesting to me to think how initially Kojima did not intend to follow up MGS2 because they do almost nothing with the whole like Ocelot having Liquid's arm thing.
Yeah.
So like I can only thank God he came back and did MGS4 where this actually has a payoff and, you know, amounts to something where like it's now a fully fleshed out idea where like their identities have now merged and Ocelot is supposed we'll get into the specifics of this later. But the fact that that's in MGS2 and they do almost nothing with it is so bizarre to me, considering that like that's all they were going to do with it.
And it became a major plot point.
Yeah.
Which is great. Like, I'm so glad this actually amounted to something, because in MGS2, like by itself, it's so stupid.
I mean, doesn't it go back to my theory where they introduce something that you think is really stupid, but then it actually ends up doing something?
It kind of makes sense.
Kind of. Yeah. They tried.
Yeah. So that's the end of Act 1. And I did want to just mention that it's these acts are interrupted by a little briefings, and
they are not brief.
Briefings, but they take place on the plane that Snake and Otacon live on.
Yep.
And you can kind of, I like that you can kind of dick around with the robot and pick up some items during those. If you're totally unengaged with the plot at this point, you can just like do whatever you want during those.
Well, that is kind of a flaw of the game. You know what I mean? Where I feel like a lot of, because I went into this game almost totally clean.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I heard about this game was the cinematics are unbearably long.
Yeah.
And I slowly started to understand why. Where like you get to the end of the mission, incredibly long cinematic. You get to a briefing, incredibly long cinematic, followed by the introduction to the next act, incredibly long. It's like you get like three giant cinematics in a row.
Like there are points where it'll take 40 minutes for you to gain control of Solid Snake.
That's unbelievable.
Again.
Yeah, you can't do that.
Oh, that's almost unacceptable.
Yeah, I think the word
is even for Metal Gear Solid, a game highly driven by its complex story and cinematics.
I sat through everything for the sake of this podcast, but there are times
when I'm playing these games for leisure that I will just hit the skip button because yeah. I understand the story. I'm just going to get back.
Because I'm pretty sure like the mission briefings, you're fed all that same information later. Like everything you get from the mission briefings, you'll eventually be fed in the next actual cutscene.
It's unbelievable.
So if you skip the mission briefings, you're not really missing out, but you feel compelled to sit through them because you don't want to miss anything.
Which I did.
Yep. So before I forget, this is I think where they introduce Sunny.
Yeah, I hated this character.
Who is Olga's daughter?
Yeah,
I like her more than Emma Emmerich.
I can't stand the voice acting.
Yeah, it's clearly an adult doing a little kid.
Sure. I mean, I liked her inclusion, though, because to me, she symbolized like the one little inkling of innocence that this world has left.
Yeah.
It's just sort of a reminder of like what we're trying to, you know.
Am I allowed to disagree with that? Is that okay?
Okay.
Like, but they kind of put her to work. You know what I mean? It's not like she's kind of like a programmer, like a hacker. She's all, you know, into like the operations. It's not like she's running around as a kid. You know what I mean?
Well, I guess like in terms of the moment, it's a contrast with Snake, who is like the most like nihilistic person on earth.
Is she the only child in any of the games? She might be.
The main characters anyway.
Not until five. You get more kids.
That's right.
So we're getting into act two. Let's get the show on the road.
Let's get the show on the road here.
South America. Vamp comes back. big groaner for Vamp. I don't like this character, but you know, whatever. Rosemary is also brought back, and I think that is actually really strange.
Yeah, sure.
Because they partially, so basically in MGS2, Colonel Campbell and Rosemary were figments of Raiden's imagination, or you know, whatever, digitally created, and they kind of sort of act like that really happened. Rosemary entered service after the Big Shell incident or something. Yeah. Do you know what I'm talking about?
And now she's an item with the real Colonel Campbell.
Right.
It's just very bizarre. It's one of those, again, it's one of those things that the game just didn't need.
Yeah.
Along with every other romance subplot. And this one especially, I mean, there's nothing in it that really like bothers me so much. It's just, I don't know why it's in there.
Because they ended up explaining, I agree with you, but they also end up explaining it away in the last hour of the game. It makes it feel even worse.
Yeah. Like it's all a trick or something.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway.
But what's weird to me, though, is that she is like your psychologist.
Yeah.
And she and Otacon are the only people you can call in the codec period this whole game. And I don't dislike, you know, less codec time because there's enough cinematics as it is. But
yeah,
it's just odd that she's one of them.
It's very odd.
She doesn't really have much to do with the story. But yeah, so she's introduced here. There's a little bit more of that kind of factional fighting here. There's some nice little war zones to sneak through.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the point of this is to find Naomi in her lab.
Yep.
I did like some symbolism that wasn't explained because, like I said, Kojima loves to explain how brilliant all his little quirks are. Her lab is covered in blue roses, which are not naturally occurring in nature, and she's a geneticist, so it's kind of cool.
All right,
kind of cool. So basically, you're kind of. I think this is maybe a little gripe I have with the game is that not only is Snake aging super rapidly, the strain of fox dye that has been in his system since the first Metal Gear Solid is now mutating. So if he doesn't kill himself soon, he will become he will start a pandemic.
Interesting. I didn't hate this. Did you not like it?
I just thought it was like a hat on a hat, I guess. Where. It's just one or the other would have been fine with me.
Sure. Oh yeah. Right. Where not only are you dying soon, you better
because you better.
You're gonna kill a lot of people.
We have a lot to say about the boss fight that happens here, the laughing octopus.
Very cool. So essentially you get to Naomi. She does sort of like a diagnosis of fox dye and what's happening to you, and then after you in the house where you find Naomi's lab. You encounter this boss that can hide herself within certain objects in the room. It was kind of scary. Mm-hmm. Where, she can hide herself in a painting, in pipes in the wall. She can actually pretend to be some of your gear, which is cool. I thought this boss was really cool. I was very into it. Yeah, I don't know what you guys think. I liked it a lot.
It's nice to at least indirectly, to have been given that that boss fight with Decoy Octopus that we were deprived of at MGS1.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Laughing Octopus, big success. But there is that a problem that I have with all the bosses in this game, or most of them, I guess I should say, is that afterwards there's this weird, I don't mind that it happens once, but it happens literally every time, where their armor falls off and they you kind of see their true form and they like slowly walk towards you and try to hug you and drain your life.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's not like, I don't know. I think it should have maybe happened the third or fourth time, where it's kind of a reveal like, oh, well, this is what they really look like.
I thought they were trying to do a sort of like a freak out where, hey, they're going to walk at you and they're very devastating, but I non-lethaled them when they were just walking at me, because I thought it might do something.
I think it just gives you like their face.
Yeah, it just gives you like a little bonus.
Because that's something you get from that. I do like that you get something from each of the bosses.
Yeah.
You get the face camo in this one. But I just like, so that part is kind of weird to me, because they're sort of like overly sexualized in a way that's just like a little too much. And after each one of them, Drebin like explains their character over Codec. I'm like, so this is kind of useless to me after I've already defeated them. You know what I mean? Like, what should have happened is that, you know, somehow we should have known more about their character beforehand to build the suspense of the encounter. It doesn't really matter, like, oh, well, actually,
this is her backstory, but she's dead.
Don't
so
give
whatever.
A shit.
Yeah.
I think the worst of these offenses is with Raging Raven, but we'll get to that
later.
Yeah.
The tracking part I really liked, where you have to follow Naomi. She's been taken by soldiers, and you kind of have to do some detective work by using the night vision.
And this is where the enemies can hear it.
Yeah.
So you can't keep it on 100% of the time, or enemies will hear your night vision.
Yeah. Really and cool. Like, there's like the deeper footsteps, because they start carrying her instead of, you know, you have to follow it that way. I thought it was awesome. Very kind of on brand for Metal Gear. Less so the APC escape with Drebin's a little bit taxing.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I remember this.
Well, he rescues you, and you get, attacked by all those kind of zombified
humans.
It's
I feel like that, you know what that sequence was, it was very 2008. Yeah. Like very 2009.
Yes. It reminded me a lot of you remember Resident Evil 5 when the thing is chasing you.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah.
It's like that.
Yeah.
Raiden is reintroduced here as the cyborg ninja of this game.
Yeah.
Fucking bonkers. Absolutely bonkers cutscene.
Yep.
I don't dislike that he became one, though. Mm-hmm. I think kind of cool that he is, you know, it's kind of even now following in Snake's footsteps, where he's punishing himself in a different way, where Snake is just like taking all this abuse, you know, whatever, and Raiden's kind of doing something similar. But he gets in a fight with Vamp, he gets really fucked up, and that is the end of Act 2.
Mm-hmm.
So then we move over to Eastern Europe for Act 3. What did you think of this stealth sequence?
Oh, is this where you're walking around in the raincoat in the city?
Yeah.
I actually like it. Mm-hmm. I get the like the feeling that the fans don't.
Yeah.
Like on the, I don't know why. Because I just think for the most part, this game's gameplay worked for me the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Where I liked, it was just varied enough, the levels were just long enough, and it was just hard enough for me to care about doing it well.
Yeah.
And maybe I had more fun with this because I successfully tailed the agent the first time, and I didn't screw it up.
Yeah.
So I kind of felt like, oh, I really kind of patted myself on the back that I got all the way through it. Yeah. Some people don't like it. I don't know why.
It's polar.
Do you guys have an opinion on this?
Is there a reason other than fan service why for this particular sequence you're disguised as a young version of yourself?
I have no idea.
Yeah. Like, so why does Snake put on the young Snake mask?
Do people know what old Snake looks like? I don't know.
Is that why? That could be why.
I don't know. I'm not sure. Maybe they're looking for someone.
I'm genuinely
looks like
asking because I don't know.
I don't
remember.
Describe myself as somebody completely different, neither young nor old.
That's true. And maybe someone in the comments can tell us why.
Yeah. So I'm agreeing with you, where it does feel kind of a different spin on the stealth, mm-hmm. where you're just following someone through the streets of the city. There's some tricks and turns where they disguise themselves as a PMC member, but they're, yep. using like a bike helmet at, yep. one point. I thought that was cool because if you're just like tranking or killing everyone, you're gonna fuck it up.
Yep.
And that is where you run into Eva from MGS3.
Well, she's revealed, boy. As Big Mama.
Right.
You're looking for someone. I see. This is why I, up until this point in the game, I was all about it and I loved every second of it.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh, who's Big Mama? Oh, it's Eva. They're tying the characters together.
Yeah.
I like it. It makes sense, and you can continue.
But of course, a giant bombshell is dropped in this scene.
Go ahead.
And it seems like Beppy's about to go on about that.
Hit it, Beppy.
That she's Snake's mother?
Yes.
No, that the support staff and comic relief from the previous game are suddenly now the cause of all the world's problems. You, right. you learn that Major, yeah. Zero is the founder of the Patriots.
Yep.
Which is, so this bothered a lot of people. It didn't bother me so much. It was very out of left field.
Okay. Because
it's not foreshadowed or built up to it anyway. The only inkling of a thing that could be considered foreshadowing is in the beginning of MGS3, there's this part where Zero says, remember, Snake, the password is who are the Patriots and lolly lule lo. But but there's nothing that happens throughout that game that would
suggest
that
this.
he's going down this dark path, or he's like suspect in any way, or he has like a dark streak to him,
mm-hmm.
or he has some weird like ulterior motives,
right.
So it is a little like what when they sort of drop this, yeah. on you, but here's the thing.
I think in hindsight it's like, oh, okay, so you know, as we all know, that the boss's death made Naked Snake become Big Boss, you know, set him down that dark path. I think it stands to reason that because Major Zero was so heavily involved in that operation, he would also have, you know, kind of his own plans or, you know, reaction to that.
Right. So, and here's why in the moment it didn't bother me so much. And I think here's why. So, because I mean, obviously it didn't blow my mind because, again, it wasn't really built up to, but it was one of those things where I was like, okay, all right, I suppose I can get behind that. And the reason for this is I played this game for the first time about 2 months before the release of MGS5. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting there like, oh, that's cool. That's what 5's going to be about. But of course, that's a story for another time. But I can understand, like, from the perspective of anybody playing that game when it was new, anybody who didn't know there was ever going to be a five. I can imagine why somebody, like, you know, experiencing that for the first time would be like, dude, what?
Yeah.
And just be really frustrated by it.
Yeah.
I think for the most part, though, it does explain a lot, and it kind of solidifies the stakes because Liquid needs access to Big Boss's body yet again. To gain access to the Patriot system and take it over, because Big Boss was the only, you know, Zero had actually had great affection for him, and you know, he was one of the only people he would trust with the keys to the system or whatever. So they're trying to get the body to get his DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole chase sequence where Eva has the body and they're hiding it in one of the trucks, and you kind of replicate the chase sequence from Snake Eater a little bit.
Yep. Where you're on the motorcycle.
I liked it. I thought there was.
It is very 2008.
Yeah,
but yeah, I mean, I like it enough.
Yeah, we said that. I think we said that about the other one. It's very 2004.
But it's very video. It's like, it's very gamey.
Yeah.
It's very gamey.
Yes. And she once again gets run through, but she's much older now.
Yeah.
And it's
yeah, she gets wounded in the same spot. Yeah, they kind of do it on purpose.
It's clearly a very grievous injury. And one of the other B&B members attacks you here, Raging Raven. Do you, mm-hmm. want to talk about your experience with that fight?
Rage! Yeah, dude, I actually like this boss.
Yeah.
I had a really interesting experience with every boss in this game where I did them all in one try, but it took me like either many minutes or hours. Like, I took them all incredibly slowly. I remember with Raging Raven, I hauled ass all the way up the tower and I took a sniper rifle out and started doing it that way. But then when he would either catch me or he would go inside the building, I would take out the Desert Eagle or an assault rifle.
She can also, like, she breaks down, like, it's all a breakable environment.
Yeah, she breaks down the exterior of the tower.
You know, you have to kind of adapt as you go on. You can fall off pretty easily, too, if she hits you with a bomb. It's probably the most ordinary, straightforward boss fight in the game.
Yeah, this is, I feel like this boss fight was one of these sort of testing, hey, what weapons did you buy? Because there are going to be some scenarios where you got to hit her at range or hit her close, and yep. I hope you came prepared.
And you're getting attacked by those drones the whole time,
yeah.
too. Yeah.
I enjoyed all the bosses in this game. This is one of them.
Yes, yeah, for sure.
Just as a character, I think Raging Raven was the only member of the B&B Corps that like annoyed me. It's just because of the noises she makes.
Character-wise.
Because again, it's like her whole shtick is that she's just mad. Like show me your rage. I'm like, it's like just basically, it's very like tell, don't show. It's like her deal is, you know, I'm so mad, which means nothing because these characters, they're not like characterized really until after they die.
Yes.
When and then Drevin tells you a bedtime story. So it's just sort of like, and I'm fine with them having like little characterization because again, it's, I think it's clear enough just how tragic it is that these women were just sort of like, you know, torn and broken and just became what they are at the present time of MGS4. So I don't really think they needed to be fleshed out in any way. Maybe have them say less.
I mean, the Cobras get nothing. Why should they?
I mean, this boss is just too anime like, I guess.
Maybe.
Right? Yeah.
There's a lot of that. So this is the second longest cutscene in the game. I think it's over an hour.
That's crazy.
Before you get back to gameplay, where Liquid unleashes his plan, and I actually like a lot of this cutscene. It just goes on way
it's just,
too long.
It's just the length of an actual movie.
The end of Act 3 is so long.
He kicks
shit.
Your ass completely. This is the first time they kind of meet in person,
face to face.
Yeah. He really knocks you on your ass. He fulfills his plan, completely takes control. They wipe out everybody else who's trying to stop them. And the body of Big Boss is burned.
Yeah.
And Eva tries to save it. Tragically, she dies.
Well, I think his plan, quote unquote, is he stops everyone's guns from firing.
Right.
Like, he can control nanomachines, the IDs in people's guns. That's, like, quote unquote, the plan.
Right.
Is that. And people can't stop him.
Yes. So, basically, what is the big thing here where he controls one of the Patriots, but not all of them?
I don't know.
And so it's basically a parent system where the top Patriot, if that's destroyed, he will own the most powerful one.
Okay.
So what they're trying to do is it's housed in a satellite, and so they need to shoot down the satellite that's follow along here. They need to shoot down the satellite in orbit using a rail gun, but all the guns capable of doing that are locked.
Yeah,
you know, they're part of the system, whatever. So they need to find one. It's a very contrived way of getting you back, but they need to find one that's capable of doing this. So what they realize is the only one that can is on Shadow Moses as a part of Metal Gear Rex.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this return to Shadow Moses here. That I think is very effective.
Yeah. So is this like the start of Act 4?
Yes.
So the return to Shadow Moses. So I thought this was really cool. Like, up until this point, I also still really liked the game.
Yeah.
Where I said, oh, we're going back to Metal Gear Solid 1. We've introduced all the characters again. This is like pretty cool. And I also really like the boss in the snow.
Yeah.
Is that pretty? I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. That's
I'd like to just briefly mention there's a cute little kind of MGS1 where you play as the opening.
Yes, when you start Act 4, you have to do the beginning of Metal Gear Solid 1.
It's another little nightmare.
It's cute.
Sequence.
Yeah, it's cute.
And I think it really conveys sort of the natural decay of time pretty well, where they mention that Shadow Moses is sinking because of global warming. And you see the security camera from the beginning of MGS1, and it just kind of falls off.
Yeah.
And it's really cool the way it's revealed in the snowstorm.
Mm-hmm.
And they start playing the old music again and everything. And in terms of like how fun it is to play, I think it's way more fun to go guns blazing in this part.
Oh, absolutely.
Because like the gecko and the dwarf gecko, the little ones are such a pain in the ass to sneak by.
You might as well just, you know, just launch explosives.
They're so like versatile and everything. Yep. You may as well just, and you know what else is interesting is that how there, you can't buy chaff grenades.
Yeah.
Which are like, they would be the most useful because they would block like enemy, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Systems and stuff. But no, I am a big, big fan of this moment. I think it's pretty incredible that it only came out, Metal Gear Solid 4 came out 10 years after the original. And it's like, it's kind of breathtaking to to play that little bit of the first game and then see it rendered 10 years
later,
incredibly later.
And what I like about this Shadow Moses moment too is that it doesn't feel like a retread. It feels like, yes, they had to go back here, and it's cool that they're revisiting like a desecrated version of like Shadow Moses. Like, it's all run down and shit.
It hasn't been
touched. It's pretty cool.
It's all like reclaimed by nature.
Yeah, it's really interesting to like see it from the like not a top down
perspective. Yes. Yeah.
I thought that was really cool.
And
it's all still very recognizable.
Yep.
And being able to like breeze through it. It's so funny because this moment was actually spoiled for you.
Yeah. There's, oh my God. Yeah. This is the one moment of the game that was ruined for me. There was a downstairs neighbor of mine who was really drunk, and we were bonding over like our shared interest in video games. And we were talking about Metal Gear Solid, and then he just blurts this out. In the fourth one, you go back to Shadow Moses. And I cut him off right there. And I just was like, dude
stop.
I know. And then I ran into him in the parking lot the next morning. And I'm like, we need to talk about last night, man. He's like, oh, dude, I'm sorry.
Oh my God.
I'm like, I don't forgive you.
Yeah. Oh, my God. No, I think it's really effective if you don't know this happening.
I don't know. At least, I mean, okay. I mean, on the bright side, it did give me that to look forward to.
Yeah.
And I still wasn't let down, but it would have been nicer if I was surprised by it.
Yeah.
So you talked about the crying wolf battle.
Oh, dude, this boss took me like 2 hours. Like I really went in the shit with this. I was all about it.
Interesting.
Yeah, definitely my favorite of the B&B core.
It's really cool. Where like at the beginning of the boss fight, I didn't understand what to do. Like, she's kind of sprinting around. She can just bash into you. And I'm like, God, what the fuck do you do? There are frogs all over there too. I'm like, fuck, what do you do? So then I kind of like crawled to the end of the map, and I kind of just hung out for a while. And I kind of like had to strategize in my brain. I'm like, do I go up in the tower? Do I try to snipe her? I'm not really having a lot of success. What the fuck do I do? Then I said to myself, fuck it. You can actually hear her crying. And if you're stealthy enough, you can hear her breathing and crying, and you can pursue her that way.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did was I just loaded up, and I would find her crying and just unload.
Right.
And it felt awesome. I thought it was
awesome to find that crying girl and just
unload.
Light her up.
It was cool. This boss was very, very, very cool.
Yeah, I like that because it's kind of a not necessarily a retread of Sniper Wolf, but like a much more modern, you know, more intense.
It felt like a bridge between Sniper Wolf and the end.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. You fight Vamp at this point.
Wait. I think the way you beat him is really cool. I don't like the character.
Yeah.
I felt so stupid for how long it took me to figure out that you just had to inject him with that syringe. But here's the thing though, because if you just keep trying to just shoot him down, there's a moment where the game it starts just trying to flat out tell you how to kill him.
Yeah.
Like, he gets back up, he starts twirling around and says shit like, as long as these nanomachines flow through my body, you'll never be rid of me. Or like, and I kept doing it because I realized, okay, I know what it wants me to do now, but I just thought it was really funny how like you can do it like over and over again, and he just gets up and says that line every time.
It's funny to imagine how long, you know, that happening in real time. But you get that syringe from Naomi earlier that suppresses your own nanomachines. That helps. Instead of stamina, you have a psych gauge in this one, and I think it's kind of cool that it kind of comes and goes with his actual mental well-being. Like if something happens where he realizes like that he's old, or, you know, it's so funny because when you return to Shadow Moses, it's like not a very glamorous arrival. Like he falls and immediately like fucks up his back, and then your psych gauge goes down a little bit. So you have to use that on Vamp.
You have to disable, because so Vamp is not immortal. His wounds close and heal very quickly because of his nanomachines, and you have to disable that by getting him with the syringe.
Right.
And also, like, I didn't really understand how to do it. I didn't know whether you had to damage him like a Pokemon and then syringe him.
Right.
Or you had, I didn't really get it, but I ended up doing it.
You have to grab him.
I ended up kind of doing it by fluke. And it was pretty cool. I mean, I liked how you have to use an item instead.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
It's a neat trick. Less successful is when you have to repel the suicide gecko.
Not my favorite, with the rail gun.
Yeah, you get that from Crying Wolf.
Yeah.
There's kind of a side-by-side battle where Raiden is fighting Vamp. And it's just kind of like, your attention is really sort of focused on the game, so that battle is lost on you a little bit. And so we get to maybe my favorite part of this game.
Oh, okay.
Where you you finally take control of Metal Gear Rex. And this sequence to me could have been really fucked up, but the fact that it controls as well as it does really mm-hmm. saved it for me. Where it's just like, it could, like, this is a stealth game mm-hmm. and it's like, it's, you wouldn't necessarily feel like, okay, this is going to be really clunky and stupid. And I didn't feel like that at all. Mm-hmm. I felt like it's because you have access to all its weapons and stuff,
the missiles and machine guns and all this
and
stuff.
And you're just wiping out all the gecko with it and whatnot. And it just feels like a great sort of payoff moment because you wind up having to fight Liquid, who's driving Metal Gear Ray, and that's yep. that's a boss fight. And it feels to me very satisfying because you are kind of driving the really beat up one, and it's Metal Gear Ray was intended to defeat all other Metal Gears, and it's so satisfying because it's kind of evoking the genetic destiny that Liquid is talking about in Metal Gear Solid 1, where it's like, well, I superior genes, inferior genes, whatever. It's all kind of in the eye of the beholder, and you know, what matters is the spirit. And that fight that they have in the harbor is awesome, I think.
So essentially, like, in this stealth game, there's a giant mech fight.
Yeah.
Where you have robot on robot. And, I mean, I thought it was fine. I mean, so you made fun of me for this in a chat a couple of weeks ago, yeah. where I said, I don't like vehicle sequences. It's kind of like a Greg gaming mantra. I don't like vehicle sequences. I don't like mechs. Not my thing. But I think it is funny how you have this espionage game, but now you're in a fucking mech battle.
But
and it's pretty fun.
My counterpoint is, number one, that mechs rule. No, number two, no, I don't. I agree with you that I don't love... I think there's a difference between this and like Megazord shit. Like these, sure. these are very kind of rustic. They feel somewhat authentic, kind of beat up. They're very like,
yeah.
And the thing about this is that you see Liquid driving it in the first game, and it's kind of like, man, what would that be like? Mm-hmm. And the fact that they didn't fuck it up, like you can
you
dodge
get to do
and
it.
Stuff,
yeah.
and you. The terrain is not getting in your way. They're just kind of like letting you rip. I think this boss fight is great. Probably my favorite moment in the game for sure, that you're able to beat him that way. But this is kind of where the game like gets into really like schlock territory.
Oh, for sure.
Oh boy.
Where the battleship comes out, Liquid's base. It's a new version of Arsenal Gear. And it has Mount Snakemore on it, and it's like the snake's face is sculpted onto it. And I'm just like, okay.
Is this where my enjoyment in the game started to end? We're getting there. We're approaching
Act 5 is a mess.
Okay.
But hold on. So Raiden shows up at the end of Act 4. And yeah. Is this where he loses his second arm or his first arm?
Both of them.
Oh, really? I thought he lost them one at a time.
I don't remember.
He gets trapped under rubble, cuts one arm off, and then you find out later, because he was trying to stop the boat from crushing Snake, he loses his other arm.
It's implied.
And it's just like, it's just one of those things. Oh my God. It's physically like impossible that he would be able to stop like the boat from. It's just like too anime, a little too anime. Much.
It has the stupidest payoff later. It would have been just fine if he lost one of his arms.
Yeah,
but we'll get to that scene.
Yeah.
This is an end of Act 4. So Liquid got what he wanted. He has the railgun. He's going to shoot it from the battleship. And this is not like as out of left field as I remembered. It's kind of built up to that Mei Ling is now a ship captain.
Yep.
It's kind of odd. So she is kind of like, it's, I don't know if you've seen the 2012 movie Battleship, but it's the exact same premise where they have to use an old warship that's not part of the current system.
Well, before we get too far, we should say that Naomi's now dead.
Who cares? It was revealed that she had like a romance with Vamp,
and she's suffering from is it cancer or degenerative disease, and she disables her nanomachine so she can finally die. It's like kind of stupid, but well, whatever.
We didn't even mention, because there's so much going on, it's so hard to keep all these different plot threads straight, about how Gray Fox tragically dies by being crushed by Metal Gear Rex in the first game, and Naomi was his sister.
Yeah.
And so she kind of dies in the same place as him. It's a little bit poetic that way, but all these, like, it's, she is kind of the exposition character, and all these like cutscenes she has with Otacon and Vamp and everything, and they just go on fucking forever. And so she's a geneticist, but she also understands like computer hacking and stuff. It's just a little too
it's
much
a lot
for me.
Yeah, I know. I agree.
Okay. I do like this last like briefing where you're in this like you're in this it's like a cafeteria, I think, and Mei Ling is showing like you on a projector of what the plan is, how they're gonna stop Liquid.
Yes.
And it's like it's the most pathetic like last group of people, like this is what it's come down to. Snake has like a mask on like for breathing, and like you have Johnny over there, and oh, we didn't even talk about Johnny.
Oh God.
Johnny is not subject to Liquid's plan because he doesn't
have nanomachines.
He doesn't have nanomachines, and that's why he's always shitting
his pants. I kind of like how they try to narrative their way out of why he always shits himself.
Yeah.
It's because he has stomach issues but refuse to correct it with nanomachines.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, like, I mean, oh my God.
But interesting.
It's oh my God. So at the end of Act 3, I think that this is when this happens.
He takes his mask off and he's beautiful.
Right. And then at no point after that does he shit himself again.
Right.
Like, yeah. It's so stupid.
So let me I have a couple different thoughts about this character. Number one, I've never seen this done before where you have a joke character who is constantly like the joke is that they're constantly shitting themselves, and then they wind up becoming like a pivotal character in like the final. I've never seen that before. Number two, I think it makes perfect sense that he winds up with Meryl.
Yeah.
Because it's like, we'll get to the details later, but in terms of, it's such a funny like final insult to Snake that not only is he not going to be able to get the girl, he's replaced by the guy that's shitting himself. How many times has that happened to you in real life, everybody?
Yeah.
Come on. We all know it. We all feel it. So it's pretty much the three of them. They have to get catapulted onto the Liquid's battleship.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a strange thing where Drebin is like, oh, I have these catapults, and you'll
this is where the game gets very anime-y, very weird. Like, I don't know, I started to fall off here a little.
I thought it was cool though that it kind of resembles the tanker a little bit.
Yeah.
You kind of get start getting that back in, and you fight the final BNB member here, the Screaming Mantis.
Yep.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
So they did a little recall to Psycho Mantis. Mm-hmm. I thought it was pretty cool where this boss is controlling Meryl again, kind of like the first game. This boss has like two dolls that are floating next to her, and you have to disable the dolls by either like shooting them. And there's a lot going. I kind of like this because it's kind of another one of those puzzle bosses.
Yeah.
Where it's so this the reason why the boss can either like control your mind or is controlling these soldiers is through nanomachines. So if you inject yourself with the syringe, you can then shoot her dolls, and then you can control the doll. It's kind
of
cool.
Well, what's cool is like, so one of the dolls looks like Psycho Mantis and it controls the living. And the other one is the Sorrow from the previous game, and that controls the dead.
So pretty cool.
A lot of dead geckos around that she can resurrect with that. And it's just like such a shame because once you pop them off, you can actually see like at certain points, like the strings coming down onto your character. Like,
yes.
You know, it was to say if it's actually there or not, but it's used to represent like the control over you. And once you inject yourself, you can, you know, they sever, etc. So, but once you use essentially those dolls to end the boss fight, but it sucks because it's like, so this is what you get from this. These items are what you get from this boss, but that's the, for all intents and purposes, the last normal gameplay segment.
So you never get to use them.
You don't really have the chance to use them outside the boss fight, which is a shame. Derek, you were voicing some grievances in the chat. I'd like to give the floor to you about
the reveal
at the end of this boss fight
where it's shown that the ghost of Psycho Mantis was controlling Screaming Mantis, and by extension
everybody else.
Rest of the BNB core,
which
is a real shame because I remember experiencing that for the first time, being like, wait a minute, but I thought he had a change of heart.
I guess
at,
not.
At the end of MGS1 only to still be a piece of shit as a ghost.
Maybe it was just a fleeting thought, and he really was just a piece of shit through and through.
it's clearly just in there for fan service, which is a real shame.
Yeah, he does the controller thing again.
Yeah,
and
I don't think Kojima like quite thought through the implications of bringing him back in this way story wise. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was cute. It was fun to see a familiar face.
Yeah.
But then when you sit there and think about it, it's like, oh, this really undermines like the transformation he went through, like as he was dying.
Yes.
In MGS1.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like the boss is cool, but the reveal after the boss is just, we didn't have to do that. It kind of makes the lore muckier.
And it's interesting too, that he gets vanquished sort of by the sorrow. And you can kind of see, like, if you, there's some hidden, you remember we talked about the L1 scenes where you can see through the characters, but there's a hidden one here where you can see the sorrow in the,
that's cool,
in the corner, and he's the one who vanquishes Psycho Mantis. But, so we're going to get into one of the worst scenes in the game here, so I hope everyone's prepared.
So, we should set this up here. So, this is, when, to get to the end of the game, the characters are talking about, okay, well, if you want to go in and disable this, you know, whatever, get in, if you want to complete this stealth mission, you have to go through almost this suicide hallway,
right,
where there are some burning literally microwaves, and Snake says, I'm going to go in and I'm going to complete the mission because I'm dead and dying anyway. Let me get burnt to a crisp.
Yeah.
So the other characters are like, they're going to buy you time to get through this. And this scene is so bad where it's just... I really, really liked Metal Gear Solid 4, okay? And just for everyone on the internet, I was in messenger chats with these guys saying, man, this game rocks. This game is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
At this point, I said, now I see why some people hate this fucking game. Like, so Meryl and Johnny are buying you time, and what they're doing is they're fighting off like a bunch of frog members in a cinematic, by the way.
Like,
you don't
like
even get to play it.
Impossible amount of frogs.
Yes. And so, but what they're doing is Johnny kind of like reveals his love for Meryl, but then they're essentially almost like dancing with guns, but like having like a romantic physical encounter, and it goes on forever. And it is so like, I don't know how to describe it other than incredibly stupid.
Cringe. It's like an action rom-com scene.
It's
like
awful.
A Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie, Mr. and Mrs. Smith scene where it's just awful.
It's awful.
And so, whatever, that goes on for some time. Raiden is also there. I don't dislike that he fights with the sword in his teeth. I think that's pretty cool.
I think it would have been just fine if he was missing one arm.
It would have been
badass enough, and it wouldn't have looked fucking stupid.
Sure.
All right, okay, so we need to talk about this too, because there's... In the lead up to Snake crawling through the
microwaves.
Right. So there's this really funny scene where he's like, Snake's on the ground, like he's having a coughing fit and like, you know, dying.
Yeah.
And like there's five frogs spot him and they just approach him with their guns pointed at him really slowly for some reason, rather than just, you know, unloading on him right then and there. It's a very like, it's just...
It makes no sense.
If plot armor could have been summarized in like a GIF, okay, and then later on, it happens again when like Raiden is fighting off the ones that remain, and he gets checkmated by like an impossible amount of them, and yet again, like he's cornered and he has no way out, and again they walk as slow as humanly possible. It reminds me of like the long night in Game of Thrones where like the whites versus extras, they just go at it, but versus John, they're like circle him and they do nothing.
There's too much bullshit.
It's way too much. It's something that this series should have been above. It's unfortunate, but I do love the microwave. It's virtually not too different from the torture sequences of the previous games where you kind of have to keep mashing to get through, and like you're just kind of slowly walking and you're seeing all the chaos unfold. You're seeing what's at stake and what's, you know, I just think it's a really effective sequence that, you know, a lot of people have obviously talked about before, but it's so cool to me that, you know, he starts out walking and gradually, you know, you kind of see his armor start to like melt
apart. Yeah.
the Mark II or Mark III at this point gets you know, starts to explode a little bit. And at the end, you're literally just crawling. And it's kind of bringing it all down to, like, you know, it's synonymous with Metal Gear Solid with the crawling, you know, the sneaking around. And it's such a different context now. It's like just like you're literally like just on your last legs.
I wonder if it would have been more effective without the split screen. If it was if you could just focus on Snake
crawling
to the microwaves. I think I don't know. I'm torn on that.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I understand.
It's something I just wonder. I don't know.
It's hard to say.
The scene before that happens, though, yet again, it's like it's that scene where him and Raiden are having that final, like, heart to heart.
Yeah.
And there's literally two frogs standing there waiting for them to, like,
finish the conversation.
How awfully nice of them.
Yeah.
They just keep doing that, huh?
I know. Yeah.
So, yeah, so this is pretty much the end where they have to upload a virus into the thing. It's really. It's a shame because there's a lot of really effective moments in this end game, like that microwave, but there's also a lot of indulgent
stupid stuff
like Naomi's big speech and Otacon crying again, and it's just like it's so taxing.
Yeah,
where it's like I don't know. I love the torture that old Snake goes through and all that stuff, but it's just like so indulgent. And On the flip side, you get into the final boss here, which I think is spectacular, and it's sort of setting up this final throwdown between Solid Snake and Liquid, and it's another thing that goes back to Derek's commentary about, like, isn't it amazing that all this went to plan? Because Liquid is revealing, like, this was my plan all along, and it's kind of like I do like that on some level. It's kind of tying back to the boss where you're living a lie just to fulfill that kind of purpose.
Yeah.
And, you know, committing to a certain ideology to prevent another.
I mean, essentially, like, you know, old Snake says to Liquid, you could have stopped us at any time.
Yeah.
And it was according to plan, blah, blah, blah.
Well, he was like, the big thing is that he was trying to trick.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because they reveal that, like, I don't think it's Liquid's arm anymore. It's like a bionic one, right?
Yeah, it's like silver. I like how they leave it like ambiguous. Like, you don't know for sure, but it's implied that it was never actually Liquid. This was just Ocelot the whole time, pretending he had merged with Liquid.
And so here's a really funny thing I have to say about that. Oh, you mean that really implausible thing you said happened was fake the whole time? Wow.
Yeah.
This series is so crazy that it could go either way.
Well, because in 2, whenever the arm would awaken, you would hear Liquid's voice,
right?
But in this game,
it's always Ocelot,
right? So I mean, I just sort of assumed that at one point or another, Ocelot just decided to remove Liquid's arm and replace it with just another bionic one.
But essentially, it's also kind of reflected in that it's so cool when they're setting up the boss fight, and I'm not like a big fan of like the Metal Gear Solid theme, but it's used pretty well here with like the muted trumpet when it's kind of like you're getting into like the final boss battle and the health bars appear and it's like MGS1 health bars.
But you kind of get the health bars from each game.
Yes.
Like they kind of change the style of the UI, the style of the HUD. You kind of go through the history of Metal Gear Solid.
To match 1, 2, and 3.
Oh, and they bring back our favorite James Bond theme, too.
Yes.
That comes back, too.
And it's changing. It changes his name from Liquid gradually to Ocelot.
Well, you know what it is? So I think the idea of this boss is cool. I didn't really like what you actually had to do. I think this game relies on too much of guy-on-guy punch fight or guy-on-guy sword fight on top of thing. Like, it happens too much. Like,
I think that was the point of this
one. I know.
One,
it's interesting. It is the point, but I didn't really love what you had to do, but I feel like I got the point of what they were trying to put forward.
I think it was just so over it. Like, you know, it's so grandiose in this sense.
My teeth hurt from how sugar sweet this is.
Like the music is reaching the point and they're on top of the thing and it's so picture perfect.
Yeah.
And then the camera changes with each fight, with each stage of the fight. And then in the end, it's kind of, you know, you're back to MGS4 and it's literally just them tossing haymakers.
Every punch is a cutscene.
Yeah.
Like the game's being very self-aware at that point. I mean, my biggest problem, I love this whole sequence for the most part. part. My biggest issue with it was how excruciatingly long the cutscene before the fight.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Like
you.
It goes on forever. It's like I want to be the guy kicking ass right now, and I want to watch the game doing it for me. Mm-hmm.
I do like watching it in a vacuum, watching them kick each other's asses. But all that bullshit with how we got there is really tough, and a lot of what comes after is pretty awful.
Does he hallucinate Otacon in the beginning of that? Because he pops up and says, "We need to get you a medic, stat," and then he's gone,
disappears,
and then
it's very unrealistic how Otacon says you need a medic, but then they're on top of this tower.
I have to imagine that was a hallucination.
Probably
Snakey.
It's pretty surreal.
He's just coming to after.
So essentially, that liquid ocelot fist fight is the final boss.
Yep,
and you get to this unbelievably long ending, like of cinematics.
I think it's legit 1 hour.
It's over. Fucking awful. Over. Most of it is. Like, is the first thing the wedding?
Yeah.
That it's God. This is unbelievably bad. I could not believe this. Where, like, you have Meryl and Johnny who are rolling around in a previous cutscene, and Meryl's like, "I want a real wedding with flowers and a dress." Yeah. And I'm like, "This is so bad." But
Then
they do it, and I'm like, "Oh my fucking God!" And like. You think they're in a wedding hall, but they're actually like on their war vehicle, and they're on like a tarmac.
My favorite part is when Drebin shows up and they imply that he's gonna like hit them. It's like, what's going on here?
Is that the point where Drebin like mansplains what the military industrial complex is?
Yes.
To the player.
It's that scene is exhausting.
It's awful, man. It's so bad.
But why don't
we get to the good shit? Because I'm just gonna complain.
Yes. So I do really like the graveyard stuff, where Solid Snake is kind of fulfilling his purpose now that he's you know, Liquid is dead, Ocelot is dead, I guess I should say, and now the only thing left is to kill himself
to stop the virus.
And I'm some people don't like this. I do like it, that it's a fake out where. He sticks the gun in his mouth and it cuts to credits, I believe.
We should say this is very specific. So Old Snake puts the gun in his mouth. The camera goes up to the sky and you hear the trigger pull.
Yes.
It's like implied that he kills himself.
Right.
But
they roll the credits and then, you know, you're seeing everybody. And then the end is like, and Big Boss played by whatever. And I'm like, wait, Big Boss.
Oh,
yeah. And then, you get an appearance by, Big Boss, who is somehow still alive. This is like the only resurrection that I don't have a problem with.
Sure.
Because he's such like a strange, like monolithic figure that it's like, well, okay. Mm-hmm. And it like in, so this runs a little long itself. There's a lot of like kind of schlocky, you know, kind of, well, here's, let me explain what really happened sort of thing. But the, whatever, you know, I don't care about any of that. What I care about is the humanity and the relationship between these two characters.
It's essentially father and son, right?
Yeah. And it's sort of like, considering how it all started, where they, you know, they have this huge history and everything, and it winds up just being this very human moment where they hug.
Yeah,
you think they're gonna fight, they're gonna have like square up for CQC, and he's like, just drop it, man.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, Big Boss says to Snake, just put the gun down, just like let it go, live your life.
And that's sort of the point of the whole scene. And I thought I did notice a few things this time where. You know, the first time we see Big Boss in 3, he's smoking a cigar and Major Zero tells him to put it out and he tosses it aside. The last thing you see is him like dropping it in this game.
Do you know what I thought was cool about this? So essentially, like, I tell me if I'm correct. Big Boss sits down at the grave of Boss.
Yeah.
And then Old Snake puts a cigar in his mouth and the game waits just a little bit too long to where you think the game is loading, but then you know he's died because the cigar falls out of his fingers.
Yeah, right. You see it.
By
drop
he,
out.
I mean Big Boss. Big Boss is dying in front of the grave of Boss.
He manages to salute one last time.
Yeah,
and there's a really weird interlude there with Major Zero, who is there in a wheelchair.
Oh my God.
And Derek has something really funny to say about
just
this.
The thought that he brought like 110-year-old Zero all the way out there just to kill him dramatically in front of Snake is really
he
funny
just like
to
shuts
me.
Off his oxygen like, or something.
Yeah.
It must have been so a really funny. As you put it, it must have been a really awkward car ride.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just kind of like this is it. Like, you know, everything is fully, completely like this is we're putting it in it. He says the world would be better off without snakes.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of putting an end to the whole saga and everything. And there's a lot of really good writing there. And it's just a shame that so much
it's surrounded by so much bad shit.
So much like bullshit. And another thing I realized. Yes. When he kills Big Boss in Metal Gear 2, he sets him on fire with the lighter. And then, like, the last time you see him, he's lighting his cigar with the lighter. And I'm like, yep. Oh, okay. So it's yep. It's used in a different context here. I just really like this scene. There's a pretty cool backstory where the Japanese voice actor for Solid Snake was estranged from his father, who is also a voice actor. And Kojima cast that actor, his father's actor, as Big Boss, so as kind of a little conniving scheme to reunite them and get them to reconcile, and they wound up reconciling because of that. And I think it's a very it's a very sweet
way to get involved in their business, dude.
Mean, I think it's a really nice thing, and it adds a nice little layer to the scene. But I love the ending, and I just have a lot of really complicated feelings about this game
particular. Kind of like I said on the last episode, we could talk about Metal Gear for so long. We should probably wrap.
Yes, let's do it.
So essentially how this ends is, you know, old Snake walks away and lives out the remainder of his life, allegedly. So anyway, how do we feel about this game? I loved about 90% of this game. Like I was texting you guys, this game fucking rocks. Everyone on the internet's wrong. How do you not like this game? In the last 10%, there is so much fucking anime dumb shit.
Yeah.
I have a bad taste in my mouth for the game. That's why it's so hard to grade, where I'm like, how do I take 90% awesome, but it ended and I hated it, but I didn't hate the graveyard scene. I hated everything around it.
Yeah.
But we'll be very, very quick here. Loved all the gameplay. I love the mission to mission. I loved all the B&Bs. There is too much anime dumb shit in this game. I don't know what to grade this. I think I may just have to like put my ego aside for it, like, and just say it. I think it's another B,
mm-hmm.
where it was so good for a while and it was shit for a little bit, but I'm going to try not to let it cloud my judgment.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it's a B for me, but it is not a B in its entirety. It's like an A and an F.
Right.
And I'm being generous.
Well, that adds up.
I guess. Anyway, why don't you go ahead, Bevy?
No, I have a lot of a personal attachment to this game because I the character of Old Snake I feel is very relatable, because to me it feels very much like, you know, you're an old man like living in the future with all these machines around, you don't recognize anything, you know, you feel very out of place, you feel very useless. So I feel very, I give it a lot of slack, I guess is what I'm saying. Sure. Ultimately, I would give this game an 8 out of 10.
Yeah.
Just because I think there's a lot of redeeming qualities. I think it gets too much flack.
Yeah. Derek, do you want to give us a grade?
I'd say B minus, I'd say.
Yeah.
I mean, it definitely gets a lot more flack than it deserves. It's not a bad game, but I don't think it's great either. I think I'd say this one's like a like, not love for me.
Sure.
Because back to my earlier point, again, most of my gripes with this game, again, if you just boil the game down to like the spark notes, if you will, the things the game absolutely needs for the story to hold together, there's not much I would alter. It's just a matter of like, you know,
cutting the fat.
Exactly. So, you know, like examples, you didn't need Drebin, just have Otacon unlock the guns. Adam and Eve references are pretty forced. You didn't need those. Every romance subplot was dumb.
Yep.
Every single one. Johnny.
Yep.
He should have just fulfilled his traditional purpose of being in that one scene where he shits himself and that's it. And not become.
It didn't have to be there.
He didn't have to become a fleshed out character. Meryl didn't need to wind up with somebody at the end. Okay. Let's see. Rosemary.
Kind of like a little demeaning to her character to have her. You know, she's such a strong and independent person. It's like, I want to get married. Like what?
It was weird.
And Otacon and Naomi. You didn't need that at all.
Yeah.
And because I forget the actor who plays Otacon, but. He's good, except for when he has to cry.
It's not good.
It's nails on a chalkboard.
I just, like, I can't listen to it.
It's so bad. And Naomi and Vamp was really weird and unnecessary.
Yep.
And then Naomi being this is the one thing I would change, really. I mean, there's probably more, but the main thing is Why is Naomi the one who developed the brilliant virus that took down the entire Patriot system?
Yeah.
And why did she reveal it in that way? Why couldn't she even like, all right, Otacon, so we're going to, Sunny and I developed this like extra like component to the virus. You're uploading it. We're putting it in the Mark III. And like, she would have, do you think like she would have tell him this very, very
vital and important thing.
Information.
There's a lot of gotcha moments, but for the sake of gotcha moments.
Yeah, like she just decides to reveal it in the most dramatic way possible, just because she can, I guess. I don't know. But what I would change about that scene is just have it all be Otacon. That would have been a huge moment for him.
I really think like, because we're gonna wrap here. I agree with everything you said. It's just, you got to cut the fat. There's too much dumb shit. Even though I think this game is very enjoyable to play, really up until the very end. So this was Metal Gear Solid 4. We are going to talk about 5 next.
See you then.
Yeah, see you then. I hope you guys are following along, because these are toughies. But
Happy New Year, everybody.
Yeah, and we'll see you guys next time for Metal Gear Solid 5. Thank you.